using Medicaid as a platform for health care reform. And I'm very pleased that we can have this briefing this morning and present to you some of the findings that have been developed through our work with the Urban Institute, through the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. And what we wanted to start with today was just to remind you a little bit about the platform that Medicaid serves, and then we're going to turn to John Hollihan from the Urban Institute to present some of the findings on what the options are and the cost implications of those options for expanding coverage for the low-income population through Medicaid. We've also got with us a very distinguished set of discussants to shed some light on the implications of these findings as well as the current debate over the future of the low-income population within healthcare reform. Karen Ignani, President and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans, needs no introduction to any group, nor does Sheila Burke from the Kennedy School of Government and former Hill staffer on the Senate side, and Alan Weil, now with the National Academy for State Health Policy, a former Medicaid director among other past responsibilities, and both Sheila and Alan serve as members of our Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. What I'd like to talk to you about as we begin in this discussion is really the platform Medicaid now serves as a role for low-income populations, and to just briefly remind us that it provides coverage to a wide range of populations that have very diverse health care needs. We're most familiar with the numbers in Medicaid who are low-income families, children, and some of their parents, especially pregnant women, children who need routine as well as specialized care, and families that have affordable coverage through the Medicaid program with very low cost sharing and comprehensive benefits that really meet the needs of a very low-income population. But Medicaid also plays a very central role to people with disabilities, covering some 8 million Americans with disabilities who are low income, that include autistic children, those with cerebral palsy, individuals with HIV/AIDS, those who need extensive services and are really often individuals that need not only medical care, but many of the rehabilitation and support services and long-term care services that Medicaid can provide. And finally, as the trustees report comes out today and talks about the dire circumstances of Medicare, I always like to remind people that Medicare wouldn't work very well for some of its lowest income beneficiaries without Medicaid as a strong supplement to the Medicare program, filling in on their cost sharing, helping to provide additional benefits, especially nursing home care, and also helping to cover the Part B premium, which may be quite an issue as we go forward in this year without a COLA increase in Social Security. But these are the roles that Medicaid plays for the low-income individuals that it now serves. But it also plays a substantial role in terms of its share of the healthcare system. It's a major component of our spending on healthcare. I've pointed out the role it plays for Medicare. It also, I think, helps some of the private insurance plans to be relieved of the responsibility for some of the very lowest income people with severe disabilities that would increase the premium payments in a market if they were in that pool. It is a major source of coverage for community health centers and many of our public health facilities and safety net clinics, and is part of our public health as well as our safety net infrastructure. Many talk about expanding coverage to the low-income population through community health centers, yet one of the sources of their payment that they rely on the most is their contributions from participation in the Medicaid program. And also, given that the low-income population lives in areas that are often medically underserved, it's particularly important to have this range of safety net facilities that can help provide those services in those areas. We need not be reminded that coverage matters. That's why we're in this health reform discussion together, that those who have no insurance don't use the healthcare system in the same way as those with private coverage or those with Medicaid coverage. And in fact, coverage matters, and we see that both Medicaid and the private insurance options provide much broader coverage and much better access than those who are uninsured. But we also know that one of the challenges we face as we go forward in the health reform debate is that those who are uninsured are unfortunately predominantly low income. And in this slide, you see the share of the pop. Two-thirds of the uninsured are under 200% of poverty, about $40,000 for a family of four. And a substantial share are actually under the poverty level itself. And one of the challenges in dealing with this population is that the eligibility and participation are not always as good as they can be. So one of the challenges is how do we boost and improve enrollment? And you see that there are children here who are eligible but not enrolled. And we see that among parents, though, and especially among childless adults, many of them are actually not eligible. So it's less of a problem of participation and more of a problem of eligibility. And that is, of course, what's on the table with the changes being proposed under health care reform. And these changes relate to the fact that today income eligibility for pregnant women and children is substantially higher than that for the elderly and individuals with disability, tied mostly to the SSI level. Working parents and jobless parents have even lower levels set and determined by the states that vary widely across the country. And childless adults are ineligible for federal matching funds under Medicaid, except when states have been able to obtain a waiver. So they constitute actually our largest group of the uninsured low-income population, our childless adults with their ineligibility for public coverage today. What I think is also important to note is that as we look at the low-income population, we're not looking at a really healthy population. We're looking at a population with a lot of mental disability, physical disability, and the combination of 40% of the poor, uninsured low-income adults report either a physical or mental condition, and 34% of the near poor. So we really need to also be cognizant as we look at the coverage options for this population that they are, because they're uninsured, not utilizing services at the level they should be, and they're likely to be needing a lot of care once they come into the system and therefore are going to be higher cost than some of the healthier uninsured that may come in at higher income levels. And just to restate the kinds of complex populations and services that Medicaid provides, we can understand why the program has such an extensive coverage network that it provides for those who it serves, given the range of illnesses that are covered. And especially important is its coverage of those with mental illness and intellectual disabilities, where both mental health benefits and acute care benefits are necessary. And as we have moved forward with Medicaid, there's been a challenge of getting providers to participate in the program under the fee-for-service system. Many of the states have moved quite aggressively to managed care and to case management so that for their low-income populations especially, they're trying to develop both a network and a way of providing services. And you see here that the penetration varies across the country but is substantial in almost every state. And finally, as we enter the debate today of what to do and how to provide coverage for the low-income population and look at some of the options that John is going to put on the table, I think it's always important to remember that when we do go to the public, there's a lot of myths about what the public thinks about the Medicaid program. And here you see that there is substantial support among the public in the polling that we do for expanding Medicaid and SCHIP as one of the options for broader coverage. So with that framework, I'm going to turn to John to talk to you a little bit about what the coverage and cost implications are of some of the options on the table. John?
All right, without my glasses, I think that's up there. Okay. All right. Okay, so the work we did was designed to estimate the coverage and cost impacts of expanding Medicaid. Let me start by just saying a word or two about my co-authors. Bowen Garrett has really led and done an extraordinary job in developing the new micro-simulation model that we have now for looking at health policy changes. And Allison Cook, Irene Hedden, and Aaron Lucas put in tons of hours to make sure that this project, as well as some others, are getting done on time. So what did we do? The idea here is to look at the costs and coverage impacts, and we looked at several different kinds of policies and what effects they would have for children, parents, and non-parents. We looked at different assumptions about participation rates. That is the likelihood that uninsured people would take up coverage, and people who, with current coverage, either employer coverage or non-group coverage, might drop that coverage. Essentially, we assumed in the base case that that people would behave as they do today, participate at about the rates around 60% or so. The second assumption is that participation rates will go up to 90%, which is pretty close to full coverage, particularly since we really couldn't deal with the number of undocumenteds that are there. So among document, this is pretty much equivalent to the coverage and cost impacts you would see if you adopted a policy but excluded undocumented residents. We looked at the effect of options by region, and then we looked at the impact of increasing Medicaid provider payment rates to Medicare levels. A word about the simulation model. The idea here is to capture the responses of business and individuals to policy changes, and in this context, it's how do individuals and families respond to new eligibility options? Do they, how many take up voluntarily? What do people do about dropping the current employer coverage or non-group coverage that they have? And those responses are come out of the model, but they're calibrated to be consistent with the published economic literature that has tried to measure these things. We incorporated to spend a lot of time going into details on incorporating state-level Medicaid and SCHIP eligibility rules so that we know the current eligibility levels, so that when we change them, we can measure the effects. We adjust for the Medicaid undercount on the current CPS, which is a complicated topic that I won't go into. We then project out to 2009, because you may have noticed that we're in a pretty deep economic downturn, and you can't use the $45 million anymore, unfortunately, because of the impact of unemployment on coverage. And our estimates are that unemployment rates are the number of uninsured in 2009. By the time the data is released in a year or so, will look like more like 49. Our estimate is 49.1 million, so that's our base. The spending numbers are in 2009 dollars. The options that we looked at were to expand coverage to 250% of poverty for children, 100% for adults, and then we said, well, what if we only extend coverage to adults to 100% of poverty? So that's 1A. 2 is going to 300% for children and 150% for adults. 2A is dropping the expansion for children and expanding coverage for adults to 150% of poverty. There actually is a pretty significant some significant implications of doing that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me go to results. First, this is coverage, and if you look at the left-hand side, if you assume current participation rates and expansion to kids to 250 and adults to 100 would pick up 9.7 million people. 2.1 would drop private coverage and reduce the uninsured by 7.6. If you go to the higher participation rates, you end up increasing coverage in Medicaid by 22.4 million and reducing the uninsured by 16.8. You get a very large effect because these higher participation rates not only apply to the new eligibles, but all those who are currently eligible but uninsured, because we're bringing everybody up to these levels. So think of it as a mandate that where that everybody has to get covered. And then look across at option two, staying with the higher participation rates, pick up another 6.8 million people and reduce the number of uninsured by about 4.1 million. This slide compares, changing the way we treat children, either covering them up to 250 and setting a uniform standard versus just leaving policy in place today. And it assumes that states don't cut back and essentially build upon where they are, but that they don't reduce coverage. So what you see is that there's not a lot of difference, that you pick up another 900 million or 9 million individuals. Almost all or literally all are children, not surprisingly. And it's not more than that because, first of all, there's a lot of new coverage of children even built into the 21.5 because of picking up the eligible but uninsured kids. But it doesn't go further than that because so many states are already at reasonably high levels, particularly the more populous and higher income states. So that's the main reason there. There's the big difference between these policies that I think is important is that if we have income-related subsidies above the Medicaid eligibility levels, there is no guarantee that states will stay where they are In terms of coverage, because Medicaid coverage above mandatory levels is optional, as is SCHIP. And if states are to bear a big burden for increasing coverage to adults, they may respond in the way they treat currently optional populations. We have not assumed that, but it's an important implication of this. The next slide shows, not surprisingly, and Diane already mentioned this, that so many of the uninsured are childless adults, so the expansion to 250 and 100, as with the broader expansion, it picks up non-parents. I mean, the biggest impact is on non-parents. Clearly picks up kids and parents as well, but the biggest impact both on new Medicaid and the reduction in the uninsured is on non-parents. Figure 6 looks at the costs. So we estimate under the first option, to 250 and 100, that it would cost Medicaid cost the government $62.9 billion. But there are offsetting savings that are important. Business, because I already mentioned that some people will drop private coverage to come in, so businesses would save $8.7 billion in premiums, and a good chunk of this is among small businesses. There are savings to individuals who are paying out-of-pocket for the employee share or buying non-group coverage or have out-of-pocket expenses. These would all go down if these people are in Medicaid, and we estimate that goes down by $19.6 billion. We also estimate that the amount of uncompensated care in the system would fall by $17.5 billion. So the net cost to the system, which is a real measure of the true economic impact, is $17.2 billion. If you go to option 2, the costs go up to $81.8 billion. You get a little bit more in offsets. The net cost is $19 billion, which is what is shown in the box there at the bottom. Let's look at in Figure 7, at the difference between Option 1 and Option 1A, 1A being the one that didn't expand coverage for children. And what you can see, the Medicaid costs are slightly higher. But what's interesting is that the system costs are a little bit lower. And what's happening here is that when you go to 250 for kids, a lot of the people who are getting picked up, there's a pretty high rate of substitution of private coverage or dropping of private coverage to come into the public program. People are essentially dropping reasonably expensive small group or non-group policies to come in to Medicaid, and Medicaid ends up so that the savings to businesses are actually greater, and individuals, greater in Option 1 than in 1A, so the overall system costs don't increase as much in 1 than in 1A. Figure 8 looks at the impacts by region, and this should not be surprising, but it is, I think, very important that the biggest impacts by far are going to be in the South, to some degree in the West. And this is places where Medicaid coverage is not as generous now, and there are a lot more uninsured people. And the problem here is that these states are least able to afford to expand coverage, so it really does set up a problem of how do you deal with that. And I'll come back and talk about that in a second. The next issue is the one of Medicaid rates. It's often said that you can't expand Medicaid coverage to any significant degree without increasing payment rates because they're too low. So we figured, okay, we certainly agree with that, and so we tried to estimate what that would be. And these are the impacts are shown here. And what we did was to estimate how much, or use published data, that is, on what it would cost to increase Medicaid rates to Medicare for hospitals. And American Hospital Association data tells us that it would mean an increase in payments to hospitals of 5%. Steve Zuckerman, who's actually here today, just published an article in Health Affairs that showed that it would take a 40% increase in Medicaid rates for doctors to get them to Medicare levels. We assume that other providers, like dentists, podiatrists, and so forth, would also require a 40% increase. And put those together, we figured out how much spending on hospitals and clinics versus physicians and other practitioners to get we can get a weighted average. And it comes out about close to 15% overall that rates would have to go up. So that's what's reflected in these two bars and the increase in costs that would come about if you increase Medicaid rates to those levels. But there's another thing that's hidden down there, and you may not be able to see it in the footnote, that's very important. If you increase Medicaid rates, it's not going to be just on the new enrollees. It has to be on everybody. So we estimated what it would cost to increase payment rates for all services used by non-dual eligibles, thinking that dual eligibles' rates are more or less set by Medicare, and Medicaid just fills in the difference. So that would add another $20.5 billion. So increasing rates to Medicare levels is costly, but its main reason it's costly is because of what you have to do to the base. So let me just sum up. Clearly, the potential is there for broad Medicaid expansions to have very large effects on the number of uninsured. There's a lot bigger effects if participation rates are high, either through very aggressive and very successful outreach efforts or through a mandate. More likely it's the latter. You're still going to see some shift from private to public coverage, and more the higher up the income distribution you set the expansion. And it will cost significantly more if we increase Medicaid rates to Medicare levels to improve access. So all those things, I think, are the key things that come out of this. But I want to say a word in closing about sort of the issue how this gets paid for. As I said, these are fairly big increases in cost to states, and a lot of that will be in states that are the poorer states in the country. So one way to do it is just simply say we're going to pay 100% of the cost of the new enrollees. The problem with that, even though it's very well, obviously well targeted, it's highly inequitable. If you've already done a lot, you get nothing. And if you haven't done it, you're going to get all 100% of the cost paid for. So it's hard to see how that goes forward, despite its advantage of being targeted. So I think then you have to look at options that are not so well targeted, but sort of relieve states of costs that they now bear. And there's a number of ways to do that. One is to increase matching rates on acute care services or long-term care services or all services. It turns out that if you really want to get as much money into these lower-income states as possible, it's better to do it on acute care services because there's a big, much bigger differences across the country in spending on long-term care. Then we could shift costs that states now bear for their share of Medicare premiums and cost sharing, shift all the – have the federal government take over all of those costs. That's been called for many times. Could eliminate the drug clawback payment that states are now making, eliminate the two-year waiting period for Medicare so that people are off of Medicaid and onto Medicare much more quickly. And all of those would probably be enough to at least be budget neutral at the federal level. Another way to do it is simply shift all the costs of dual eligibles to the federal government. And that has, I think, enormous advantages from a policy point of view to allow a better coordination of that care. It's probably more money than you need, for one thing, but it's also the biggest beneficiaries of that would be the states that have spent the most on the dual eligibles. They tend to be the states that would, like in the Northeast, that would have the least incremental costs of expanding coverage up to the poverty line. So there's a lot of ways to do this, and we're going to release a report soon here that will have the national estimates of doing that. And I will say that it's, you know, it's hard to do the state-level estimates. I think it's not that difficult to make this budget neutral at the federal level, but make it budget neutral for every state, both the expansions and the offsets, is very hard. It would require a huge amount of federal dollars. So I think the question is, if you're going to have to put up some money but get a huge federal match and the economic benefits that would come to a state from that, seems to me that's a reasonably good deal, and we ought to, you know, be able to work something out, and states should be happy. Not that they will be, but I think they could figure out a way that they should be. So I'll stop with that.
Thank you, John. So clearly John always gives us a lot of numbers to contemplate and a lot of implications from those numbers. I think one of the takeaway messages here is that it's not just eligibility levels, but it's also participation rates that matter in getting people who are eligible to enroll. And we come to concepts like an individual mandate that could also be applied to the low-income population, or ways to improve outreach and enrollment in the program, as we've seen through the SCHIP program experience and through Medicaid as a participant in the expansion of coverage of children. Also looking at the fact that it's not the children that are the focus here of the uninsured coverage, but it really is the low-income adults, both the parents of those children and the childless adults, and some of the policy implications of treating parents different from childless adults as we have historically may also be continued in the future. And finally, I think the financing issues always stay with us. And so with a few opening comments, I'm going to turn first to Karen Ignani to share her perspectives and then to Alan and Sheila.
Thank you, Diane. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. And John, congratulations. A very, very provocative and important study. And congratulations to the Kaiser family for making all that possible. I wanted to begin by letting everyone know where we stand on the Medicaid program and its role in healthcare reform. We, about 3 years ago at AHIP, our board issued a proposal to get everybody covered. We are strongly supportive of that goal, and we want to accomplish it this year. As part of that work 3 years ago, Medicaid, the program, we viewed that as a very important part. The safety net we thought needed to be repaired, so we came to a policy recommendation that we maintain today, and we are delighted to see these data because I think it moves us yet another step closer. The concept of embedding in reform a doing away with, an upending of the categorical restrictions and requirements. Those are outdated. Nobody understands them. They vary from state to state, creating significant inequities across the population in our view. We ought to have an income standard very plainly set out and clearly set out in Medicaid. We've recommended 100%. Everybody under 100% needs to be eligible for Medicaid. We have to shore up the safety net, and that's been an important policy position for us. We will maintain that throughout the discussions on health care reform. We have eight issues. I'm a list maker, seven issues, actually. And as I was preparing for this last night, I made my list of issues that I think are very complementary to the matters that John put on the table and that I know Alan and Sheila will undoubtedly talk about as well. Number one is dispensing with the categories. So we have an income test for Medicaid, and it's clear, it's transparent, it's equitable across the country. There shouldn't be an inherent advantage of living in one state versus the other, and that's what we have today in Medicaid. Number two, Diane, in her opening comments, quite appropriately talked about the need to expand outreach. We've been working with Ron Pollack and Families USA on this concept of one-stop shopping. We need some of that is embedded now in SCHIP legislation. We need to do a better job of making sure we're capturing everyone who is eligible, and particularly if the country sets the simple income eligibility standard. Third, we are strongly looking at the concept of a permanent countercyclical ability in Medicaid so that as we looked at the economic downturn this year, members of Congress had to scurry around, state governors and others, advocates, had to come to Washington to demonstrate what we inherently already know, that in times of downturn, states are hurting, their budgets are under more stress because we have higher unemployment. So if we're going to consider repairing the Medicaid safety net, this whole concept of a countercyclical ability built into the program with certain conditions ought to be raised in our view. Fourth, and this will probably ignite many, many people who are here and watching, we have to relook at the federal match. Because if you look at states the various sides of the country, there are a certain number of very wealthy individuals who are skewing the formula, so it means that their share is proportionately lower than other states. It's time to take another look, in our view, at whether that formula continues that was set out so many years ago, continues to be relevant for today's population. Because if you look at the wide variation in matching rates, and you look at indigenous issues that are peculiar to certain states, there's not a lot of a rationality associated with some of the lower matches in certain states. So we think that needs to be looked at. Fifth, we need to look at ways to improve long-term care and care for the disabled in particular. We need to look at the duals. There needs to be a much broader, better strategy for the duals. Our health plans have found that very significant results in coordinating care for dual populations. We need to end the idea that we're going to be thinking about the long-term care and disabled population in a waiver situation for community-based care. That makes no sense to us given the developments in the delivery system. We think that everyone should have a care plan and they should be directed to the care that's appropriate for them. So we've been working very closely with ADAPT. We agree with their comments. We agree with their advocacy that we have to do a far better job of getting folks to the right care at the right time. The sixth issue is that there is an inherent problem for plans that are managing care in Medicaid. We don't have the benefit of the state rebate, the rebate that the states get. And the problem here is that there's an incentive now built into the program for states to carve out drugs because when they use managed care, they depend on managed care to provide better care, more coordinated care. They don't get the financial advantages of that. That also should end, in our view, because we know that job one is coordinating not only the care services but the prescription drugs so we can do the best we can for individuals and get them the right care. The final thing, which Diane and John also talked about, is the issue of payment adequacy. And John talked about that. You saw numbers, which are very important, we think, for this discussion. But we're not going to accomplish this goal of safety net repair if we don't look at how physicians and hospitals and providers are being paid under Medicaid. And we have to have that conversation, we think, straight up. There's a principle that's built into Medicaid, which is actuarial soundness, which is a requirement that the funding be actuarially sound. We find very little of that across the country. And we've worked very hard with advocacy organizations to try to address these issues. But that principle needs to be taken far more seriously because we are not accomplishing a goal of repairing the safety net unless we really are attacking the payment side so we can guarantee that the best providers will be available for people with disabilities, people who need long-term care, and women and children. So that's where we are, Diane, on health care reform. We think Medicaid is an important part of that.
Thank you, Jerry.
Ellen.
Thank you, Diane, and thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation for keeping the attention on this critical issue and John and colleagues for doing this important analytic work. I get to work with states all the time and then have to say at the beginning of my remarks that I do not speak on their behalf. So here are a few observations based on my work with them. The first is that as we look at creating a national floor of coverage through Medicaid eligibility, this is going to be disruptive. And as John notes, it's going to be the implications are variable across states around the country. Let's just say that there's a lot in health reform that is likely to be disruptive. And on the disruption scale, this is probably only moderate. And so we should not be deterred from doing this important work by the problem that John raised at the end, which is that it's very difficult to hold states harmless against all changes that might occur as a result of changes in eligibility. The variations in coverage are largely a result of historic choices related to welfare, historic choices related to the granting and application for waivers. It is time, if we're going to have any sort of a national commitment to health insurance coverage, to have a solid platform on which that coverage is based. I would note, however, that the issues here are not just about the financing. They're also about state capacity, about administrative systems' ability to handle this number of people, their enrollment in health plans, if that's where they're getting services, simply processing applications. Those kinds of rather banal activities are actually quite complex. And indeed, the participation rates, which are so central to the cost estimates, are heavily determined by state policy choices with respect to the ease or complexity of the application process. And so while I know it was somewhat tongue-in-cheek to say that states should want this, whether they want it or not, I think states' enthusiasm with respect to increasing the floor of coverage will have an effect on the fervor and with which they pursue finding and enrolling these newly eligible populations. So we need to keep the state interest in mind if we want to achieve the goal of coverage. Second, there's a great deal of interest in improving the relationship between Medicaid coverage and the private coverage that people hopefully will obtain as they move up the income scale. This is a very important transition because we know that the income of low-income families is quite volatile. We have a general hope that employers will pick up and retain their share of the cost and of coverage. And so the transition between public coverage and private coverage is very important. Unfortunately, behind that very reasonable goal lurk a number of policy choices and options that could fundamentally impede our goals of simplicity, as Karen suggested, and other goals for health reform, and I would draw your attention to two of them. The first is the notion that we're going to offer all of these newly eligible folks coverage through some new connector exchange market, whatever you want to call it, and then we're going to wrap around a traditional commercial package with all the additional benefits that Medicaid provides. State experience with benefit wraparounds is not particularly good. It's one thing to wrap maybe a transportation benefit around a comprehensive medical package. That's not a medical service, and it's not traditionally part of a commercial package. But when you start thinking about things like EPSDT, when you start thinking about things like case management or more in-depth therapies that someone might need that would be capped in a commercial product, this adds a level not only of administrative complexity, but really barriers to access to services that this vulnerable population requires. And so although it sort of rolls off the tongue, well, get the base benefit over here, wrap it over there, on the scale that's being discussed as we move up the income scale for Medicaid eligibility, the potential for having benefits available on paper but not in practice becomes quite substantial. Similarly, there's an interest in premium assistance, something that most states do in their Medicaid program. We want people who have an opportunity for private coverage, employer-based coverage, to retain that coverage. But again, the complexities of administering and assuring benefits within premium assistance should not be underestimated. Take the simple point of simplicity of enrollment. We want a simple eligibility threshold of 100%. But when you do premium assistance, you have to ask people, who's your employer? What health plan do you have? What are the cost-sharing provisions? What are the benefit exclusions? How is it paid for? And how do we flow dollars between the employer, the employee, and the health plan and some wraparound benefit to make sure that you get a comprehensive package? This delays the determination of eligibility and undermines the simplicity that we're striving for. So again, it's not as if we shouldn't have these programs, but as we move up the income scale and we're thinking about potentially having millions and millions of Americans with wrapped benefits and premium assistance, and that's what we call a Medicaid expansion, I think we're really undermining what a Medicaid expansion could accomplish. This is not to say, of course, that what we want to do is take folks and just throw them in a connector with a commercial product. Medicaid is a lot more than just commercial insurance with zero or low cost sharing. It has a set of consumer protections and benefit enhancements that really go beyond what traditional products offer. And so we need to not just think of this as insurance plus. It is a different product for a vulnerable population, and we need to respect the needs of that population, or else we're simply saying we're expanding coverage without expanding access. The final point I would make has to do with rates. We do often talk about the need to increase rates, and of course, states facing tough budget times tend to scale back rates as a way to prevent the worse, what they view as a worse option, which is rolling back eligibility. And we talk about rates largely as an access issue and as a cost issue, and there's no question it has implications for those. But it seems to me we ought to think about bringing Medicaid rates up to something more like Medicare rates as an opportunity for the kind of delivery system improvement that everyone is talking about as necessary as part of health reform. It's if you look around the country at the innovations often driven by states to pursue medical homes, to pursue an emphasis on primary care, these are all-payer efforts. And in fact, the one payer who often is not at the table is Medicare, but Medicaid usually is, and the private plans, many of them are. It's all-payer efforts that drive changes in behavior of providers, because providers want to practice one kind of medicine. They want to have one consistent set of incentives coming from the very various payment streams. An increase in Medicaid payments and an integration of Medicaid payment into all-payer efforts to drive delivery system reform is an opportunity for the kinds of changes and increased efficiency in the healthcare system that we have now with health reform. And if we leave Medicaid payment in a separate category and do it separately, we lose that tremendous opportunity. Medicare has had some interesting leadership around payment reform, but they treat experimentation, they take the concept of experimentation very literally. They want to have a box in which they make their changes and they measure the effects of those changes. That's a very important source of data, but it is not an effective way to change the overall healthcare system, and we need Medicaid's participation in those. So I would just close by saying something along the lines of what Karen did at the end of her remarks. We tend to think about and talk about these Medicaid expansions, but we're largely focusing on families and kids. 43% of Medicaid expenditures are associated with people with disabilities. A similar percentage of Medicaid expenditures are associated with the dual eligibles. Of course, there's some overlap between those two numbers, but only some overlap. If we're serious about Medicaid playing a positive role into the future, we need to not only get it right with respect to these income thresholds, but we need to be improving the delivery of care throughout the populations that Medicaid serves. So I think it's terrific that we as a nation are having a discussion, a serious discussion, about creating a solid platform of coverage that people can rely upon no matter where they live. And I think it's great that the notion that that should take place has become really a mainstream view and is considered almost as a given by those who are pursuing reform. But I do think how we do this may be just as important as that we do it. And so as we move forward to the next level of the discussion about health reform and about Medicaid reform, we need to keep an eye on what it really means to the populations we're serving as we move this threshold and create a national floor so that we don't just create that floor, but we create a floor that really provides people with the benefits that they need.
Thank you, Alan. Sheila.
Thank you, Diane. My thanks as well to the foundation for keeping this issue alive for all of us and for the work of the commission. As commissioners, Alan and I have had the benefit of seeing the kind of background and work that the staff have done to provide this information. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here with a group of really distinguished colleagues. As I was thinking about this topic and preparing to talk with all of you today, it brought to mind an article, and I tried to find the article in my files that was done some years ago, and the title was The Little Engine That Could. And it was a story about the history of Medicaid and the role that Medicaid has played. And it brought to mind some of the original views of Medicaid and some of the challenges that it has faced, as well as its history in terms of a sort of a, one hesitates to say, sort of the bastard child of the discussions of the 60s, sort of came along late, but has played an extraordinary role over the years in caring for a very remarkably challenging population. It's interesting to me in today's debate that the discussions we're having today and the ones that are taking place on the Hill are those not about whether Medicaid ought to continue, but whether and what role it should play in the context of health care reform going forward. So it is clear that it will play a role. That's quite evident from the materials that we've seen. And the discussion is about the framework and really the dimensions of that role going forward. I think Alan has laid out for you a terrific list of challenges that we have to confront in dealing with this question, and ones that I think ought to influence the way we think about the changes going forward. As evidenced in the materials that the Finance Committee put forward only yesterday, there are clearly a mixture of views as to what the role of Medicaid should be. Whether it is, in fact, an organization that is going to be called upon increasingly to play a different kind of role going forward. No one questions the role of the program historically. For the most vulnerable populations, the disabled, the aged, the very low income, the benefits of the program as originally designed and as they have changed over time, address the very unique needs of that population. And Alan has done a terrific job of noting that it is not a simple thing to simply wrap around or simply redesign what it is that Medicaid has done for these unique populations. And as Diane pointed out, the results benefit a number of other players in the system. They clearly benefit the insurance companies in a sense because essentially this population is one that the traditional insurance model would not have taken care of. It clearly benefits the Medicare program in terms of dealing with a unique set of populations and helping to essentially manage that population and the kinds of things that it provides. The successes of the program, I think, are known, as are their challenges and the challenges that it confronts, and as Alan clearly pointed out. But as Congress approaches this, and again, as we saw a Finance Committee's document yesterday, it's really a question of whether to build or buy. To use Medicaid as the base upon which we build additional coverage, or essentially buy private coverage through the exchanges or whatever these new organizations are going to be for this population. So at issue, I think, and Diana asked me to talk a little bit about how Congress approaches this question, are really questions of cost. We've seen in John's work a tremendous opportunity to look at what the exposure would be or the costs would be that would be incurred by both the states potentially and the federal government were we to use Medicaid. And this question, cost to whom, will be critical. That is, whether it is a federal cost that is borne on the federal government and relieves the states of certain costs. But Alan has also done a nice job of helping us understand how that nets out in terms of the system, and that is sometimes something that we forget. Whether or not to break up targeted populations. We've seen in Karen's suggestion that simply establishing an income level rather than the categorical requirements that we built the program on is one option to essentially build that base. But that raises a series of questions. That, along with everything else, is not a simple question to ask. Whether or not some stay in Medicaid, what it is you expect of the states or of the program in terms of a maintenance of effort, an issue that is certainly comes to the forefront each time we talk about Medicaid and Medicaid as a potential expansion. Whether some of the new enrollees are based on the current model, essentially the populations that we've traditionally served, some of what John has given us in terms of the models of essentially increasing the federal poverty line, or whether you expand it to populations not traditionally covered, at least as a requirement. Singles and childless couples are the obvious population and ones that certainly are the most exposed today in terms of either falling into the individual insurance market or simply falling out of the system. And then there is this issue of the extraordinary variation among the states. As Alan has suggested, simply suggesting we all move to one level ignores the realities of the enormous variation in states and how the states would respond to such a suggestion. It raises a series of questions about the size of government. There'll be a lot of discussion about whether or not using Medicaid as a platform for a certain population will dramatically increase the presence of the government or move us towards a single-payer system. That will be one of the concerns that are raised, and they're not unlike some of the concerns we heard around the CHIP reauthorization, about whether those same issues need to be brought to bear in terms of this as a part of a long-term solution. What the pushback from the states will be. As Alan suggested, there are states who have been very responsible over the years, who have essentially covered vulnerable populations that have not been within the categorical requirements, and whether or not in doing anything we relieve them of some of that burden, or whether we simply add to that by bringing everybody else up, but not essentially dealing with the commitments they've made. There are questions about capacity. Again, the suggestion that we can simply change the income level and the states are capable and prepared to deal with an influx of new populations, how long that transition might take, the complexity of moving to a simple system, a simple enrollment system, is not at all simple, and clearly one of the things that has to be asked. Again, states would be happy for a buyout, whether a buyout of essentially of the new populations, but also some of their existing populations. The traditional suggestion of a trade-off of essentially moving the dual eligibles entirely to the federal government, or whether or not you essentially, in terms of looking at those populations, pick up certain activities, long-term care, for example, or acute care services, whether you trade that off. So the relationship between the federal government and the states around this program is a very complicated one. I was quite interested in Karen's list that one of the things that she suggested as we sort of go down these possible solutions is to relook at the match and the formula that's used for a match. I remember vividly some years ago an extraordinarily unpleasant exchange that took place on the Senate floor between me and a member of the United States Senate from a southern state that will go unnamed about the matching formula and whether that state was disadvantaged as compared to some of its colleagues. So the suggestion that we ought to relook at the match is, makes perfect sense, but the politics of that and what is considered essentially available as a resource in the state is not at all a simple question to deal with. And there is this fundamental question of the private and public sector roles. Karen suggests that we, for example, move up to 100% and require everyone and remove the categorical eligibility, certainly something that people have talked about, something that something makes sense in a variety of ways. But it begs the question about whether or not the insurance industry in its current structure is prepared to take on everyone else above 100% and whether that is the right venue for those populations. Certainly the very low income are a population that the insurance company acknowledges they are perhaps not best prepared to deal with for a variety of reasons, the linkage to the workplace, the needs and services that have to be provided. But again, is it that everybody above 100% suddenly can move into that system with acknowledging all the questions that, in fact, Alan has raised about whether that is the right venue, whether the right services, whether wraparounds essentially solve the problems that are confronted by these populations. One of the other things I think that the Congress will certainly consider and look at, and you see again in the Finance Committee materials, John gave a tremendous overview of what the cost implications are of using Medicaid as a base. What we don't know is the comparison. That is, what is it that will cost the government to essentially purchase coverage for these same populations above 100%? So that if essentially you use Medicaid as a base up to 100%, but essentially then assume you're going to buy in everybody into an exchange environment, what are the cost implications? Are they likely to be less expensive in a subsidy to a private insurance for that same coverage, assuming that you have to do a wraparound for certain populations? So, again, I think one of the things the Congress will look at is what the cost implications are of these options. And also this question of access that that has been raised both by Karen appropriately as well as by Diane and by Alan in looking at the system as we know it today. There is no question that there are a unique set of services and providers that deal with this population. They are community health centers. They are relatively non-traditional, one might imagine. And so the question is, how does one acknowledge that system in either buying them into a private sector model that perhaps has less experience in dealing with safety net hospitals, in dealing with community health centers, in dealing with the locations where many of these populations are currently serviced, and whether or not that, in fact, is also a question, and that is how one gets one into the system. There's no question that there have been issues with respect to Medicaid over the years. The number of physicians, for example, willing to accept Medicaid patients is something that has troubled us for many years. But again, there are a unique set of providers who have, in fact, taken on this population and serviced them quite well, and whether we can assume that that same population of providers will be dealt with and acknowledged in the same way in a model that essentially is built on a private sector rather than the sort of public sector model. So again, I think the question is not whether Medicaid will play a role. It will be the dimensions of that role. And I think what you've seen in both Alan's comments and some of the suggestions that Karen has made, there are a fair number of questions that the Congress will have to deal with in trying to balance out both the needs and desires of the states, the enormous variation around the country, and therefore the variation in the populations that have to be served. We certainly look to Massachusetts, for example, as one of the places that has begun to take on this issue and quite successfully in terms of the number of uninsured that have been dealt with, but one has to acknowledge that Massachusetts was a very different place than you will experience in the rest of the country. They had fewer individuals who were uninsured. They had a system that was quite different in terms of the resources that were available in the role of the nonprofit insurance industry and the provider community. So again, we ought to look at that example. We ought to look at some of the issues that some of the other states have raised in moving forward, but recognize that Medicaid will play a role. It will be a platform. The question is how big a platform. It's a question of what the balance will be between the traditional public service programs as well as the private sector and how best to match those two resources.
Thank you. Well, obviously, we've done a lot to demonstrate that Medicaid is a complex program for a complex population, but also the tip of the iceberg of the complexity in system-wide healthcare reform that we're now contemplating as a nation. And some of the issues we've raised here around Medicaid
kind of pale in insignificance when judged against some of the broader issues about how do you structure an exchange, who do you put into it, and how do you set as the rules for that exchange. We welcome, though, your questions. I'm sure that we have inspired at least a few provocative questions from the audience. If you would raise your hand, and we will bring a mic to you, and please identify yourself, and if you want to pose a question to one of the panelists, state so, but state your name as well. Thank you.
Hi, Vicki Gottlisch, Center for Medicare Advocacy. Thank you all for your comments, and John, for your report. Many of you talked about the costs to the federal government and the states, but I'm interested if anyone has done any analysis of costs to individuals who are currently in the Medicaid program. We know when Medicare Part D went into effect, even with the low-income subsidy, there were some Medicaid individuals who are now paying way more out of pocket because they had been in states where Medicaid had picked up cost sharing. And so my concern is that if we move to a floor, if we move to some additional models, we might have some current Medicaid enrollees and beneficiaries who end up with fewer services or being required to pay more out of pocket, and I wonder if anybody has done any looking at those kind of issues.
We didn't directly, but I mean, I think what this study shows is there's enormous numbers of people whose payments out of pocket for insurance or services is going to go down by a huge amount. I think the case in which somebody could be worse off is that if states do drop back in part to be able to afford their share of the newly mandated coverage, whether they cut back on some optional populations, those populations could be in a situation of having to pay more. They would, under a comprehensive reform, go into an exchange, and then it depends on what protections lower-income people have within those exchanges, what benefits are available, and so forth. So, but my guess is it would not be as generous as what you see in Medicaid, so there'd be some change there, I think.
Karen?
Vicki, I think you raise a very, very important point, and I was struck with the very incisive analysis that Sheila did about the politics of all of this. But one of the issues that I think provides some instruction, and Sheila, you indicated this as well, although Massachusetts is different than other states, yes, for all the reasons you suggested, I do think they have it right in thinking about if you've took Medicaid up to 100%, leaving aside all of the complex issues that everyone has talked about in terms of financing that, where the states are now and how we get them all to a certain point and over what period of time. Then I think there's another group of people, 100 to 100 and fill in the X, that would need the kind of cost-sharing protection, out-of-pocket caps and so on and so forth. And I thought Massachusetts has actually provided a framework, not necessarily this is the perfect way to do it, but a framework to think about the complexity of this. So safety net in terms of Medicaid, what's its responsibility, and then as you start thinking about benefits packages, we clearly have to be sensitive to the people under a certain income level in terms of their ability to finance out-of-pocket kinds of requirements in any kind of essential benefit package. So I think you've raised a very important issue, and I'm certain, based on conversations with both the Finance Committee, the HELP Committee, and over on the House side, that people are thinking about this.
And Alan?
So I think that's right, but I also think that we run some real risks in thinking that a gross income measure is the only test of the need for financial protection, because it's really the relationship between income and health status, need for health services, that determines the exposure of a family. And a lot of the complexity in Medicaid eligibility is not tied to the income side, although there's plenty of complexity there, but it's tied to the health status, the tremendous variability in the population served by Medicaid, the desire to target benefits to people who really need them, and that can include people whose incomes are in 300-400% of poverty who have a seriously disabled child, and all of the gradations in between. And so I think the risk here is that we say, well, the poorest, we know they need protection, but once you're above a certain point, you're okay as long as you don't have high levels of cost sharing. It keeps getting more complicated than that. And without replicating all of the complexity we have now, I think there are ways we can move to a simpler standard, but it can't just be income.
And Vicki, I just say that while it's easy to model how to change from where we are today, it's hard to model what's going to happen under a system that hasn't been defined yet. So I think you raise a very good research question that we should keep in mind, but we need some more details on the other side of the equation to do it. Next question.
Hi, I'm Meg Murray from the Association for Community Affiliated Plans, and I had a question for John about your assumptions about the role Medicaid managed care plans would play in the expansion. Diane pointed out that 60% of the people are in some type of managed care, although that includes PCCM, and actually for SCHIP it's even higher, it's about 75%. And so I was curious, in your model, what percentage of people or expenditures do you assume would be in Medicaid managed care, and what assumptions do you assume that they would save over the current fee-for-service system?
We don't make any assumptions about how many people would be in managed care. Essentially, the assumption is that Medicaid spending would be, as it is today, adjusted for health status. And so to the extent you're bringing in a healthier population, it's going to be less expensive, and by and large that happens. But so it's the same configuration of managed care versus fee-for-service that you see in existence today is essentially what's assumed.
Okay. Next.
Bob Rosenblatt. I'm writing about this for the new Kaiser Health News Service. A couple of questions. John said that would require a huge amount of federal dollars to hold the states harmless. I'd like to know how much that would be. And then also to have Alan and Sheila discuss the politics of this. I talked to Carol Steckel, who runs Medicaid in Alabama and who's the head of the Medicaid Association this year, and she said she is very nervous about this. She can barely keep her program even with the stimulus money she's got. When it runs out in 2010, she doesn't know what she's going to do. And she said to cover all adults, childless adults, it would cost her $80 million. She has no idea, she says, where the money would come from unless it all comes from the feds. So how much would the feds have to kick in? How would the states do this? And would it require something like perhaps a new tax on insurance companies to help pay for all of this?
I think the way you think about that is, we put out different estimates of depending on the coverage expansion, but the broader ones got up around $80 billion, and I think the ones to 250 in the $60 billion range, and then if you raised Medicaid rates, say on top of that 61 or 62, you get in the low 70s
per year,
right? Not a 10-year number, so roughly 60% of that would be federal, that gets you, 40-some, and then the balance would be borne by states. If the federal government was going to pick up that cost, either through restructuring matching rates or shifting some responsibilities to the federal government, that would mean essentially the federal government's picking up all of that $70 billion, and leaving the marginal cost to states at zero. And, one of the things that I said was that that to be budget neutral at the overall would mean some states will be winners and some states are still going to have to put in some money. And the winners being that they would spend less than they're actually spending today. So the question is, do you let people be losers, or is there one-time payments to them so that nobody's a loser? That just increases the federal costs even more. If you do such a huge number of kind of matching rate changes and shifts and so forth that nobody's a loser, you're going to create some huge winners, and the federal cost is going to be well above that $70 billion. So it's a tricky thing. My own feeling is that if the states that haven't done much have to put in some money, it's not the worst thing in the world, because they're going to get a huge match on that. There are states that would probably get a 3-to-1 match or so. But that's the economics of it. The politics are obviously quite different. So we have to see. These are complicated calculations.
Alan.
Well, let's just say this is not a good year to be talking to states about an increased outlay for much of anything. And I think the overwhelming majority of states would have the same answer. You know, we're struggling to hold on to what we have. The thought of taking on a new burden is impossible. I'm not sure substantively there's a lot that can be added to John's answer. It's exactly right. If you froze the Medicaid program, you can calculate the number of federal dollars, it would take to buy the coverage for all the people you want to cover. But if you don't do that, because there are states that would have some bad feelings about a whole bunch of dollars flowing to other states when they've been paying this cost on their own, you have to come up with any of a range, and it's probably a collection of policy changes that assist those states. And once you do that, the numbers just start growing, and there's no easy way to answer it. There might be some offsetting benefit for states that have already done more if you have a subsidy structure above Medicaid that's income-related, and you have states that are already putting some of their own dollars into coverage at that next level of income. Those states might actually receive some money back because the federal government would be paying the subsidy instead of the state. Unfortunately, I don't think there's a lot of money there, but it's the right. At least it moves in the direction of helping those states that have already moved ahead. So sitting next to Karen, I don't think I should say anything about the possibility of an insurance tax. I think the real question that John poses correctly is, at some point, if the nation as a whole is making a commitment to universal coverage and the federal government and federal taxpayers are putting out a lot of their money to make this happen, is there a point at which you can say to states, you have a role to play in this, in financing it beyond the role that you're playing now? And as I say, I don't think today you'd get a lot of states standing up. But if you went back a couple of years, you'd find many states that are trying to solve this problem and feeling like if they had a fixed amount of outlay that they had to contribute to a solution to this problem, it might be less than what they were imagining they were going to have to pay a couple of years ago when they were thought they had the resources to do this. I think the certainty into the future would be important. But as I said at the beginning, you know, it's organizations like the Governors Association, the Conference of State Legislatures that speak for the political aspects of this, and I certainly wouldn't try to do that.
I mean, I think I agree with everything that Alan has suggested. The history in the Senate and the House, but the Senate particularly, is such that making these kinds of changes certainly tries to avoid a loser. And, you know, we used to literally go through charts where we showed exactly what the result was of a change in the match rate and who won and who lost and what the adjustments were going to be to those who were potentially losers. So the instinct is to essentially create a level playing field among the states. And one of the complexities of this issue is the enormous variation and the fact that there are states who have essentially chosen to expand where others have not. And there is, in fact, this history of real opposition to essentially bailing out those who have been failed to be responsible as compared to those that have not. The other question I think that is quite interesting, that I would go back to one of John's earliest comments, which certainly struck fear in my heart, and that is what they believe to be the new estimates for the uninsured at the end of this year. If, in fact, we're looking at going to 49 million, as John suggested, one of the challenges the states will have to deal with is simply the existing system. And essentially, it's not only new populations, but essentially those that are currently eligible in the current environment. And one of Karen's points, which is this question of a countercyclical adjustment to the states that acknowledges that that what has occurred is certainly something I think the states would look at quite favorably, even on their existing population. So I think we have both the question of the essentially the increase to the base, that is some kind of adjustment for new populations, but also the challenges the states are going to be facing and simply dealing with those that are currently eligible, whether they in fact are reaching out to try and pick up some of those people, I think will also complicate these questions. And then finally, I think, again, as you look at what has been put on the table, this question of transition is quite a serious one. The exchanges arguably would not be available even in the best of circumstances if you assume that they are going to be looked to pick up some of these populations. And there's got to be some expectations that the states can try and help deal with some of that issue in the short term, because they have the systems in place, because Medicaid is up and running, because they have the administrative capacity. So the states have also got to be wondering, are we going to hit, even in the short term, some of these populations that maybe over long term would be purchased into a private sector model, but certainly short term are going to be dealt with. So I think the states are going to be leery of, you know, we'll promise us now and we'll pay you back later. And they're certainly going to be leery of certain states essentially benefiting more than others.
I think Sheila and Alan did a great job answering, Bob, your question about the financial horizon, the politics, et cetera. So I'm not going to repeat what they said. I'll go directly to your question about the health plans. I think surtaxes make politicians feel great because they don't have to bear the rage from voters of enacting additional taxes. The fact is surtaxes are passed on, and so it's one of the least progressive ways to do it. We have to finance health reform. We ought to do it in the most progressive and effective way possible, and I think that that may involve some surtaxes linked to products that are fueling the obesity problem, which is running through all the healthcare stakeholders, and you know, then we're left with how else do you raise the funding? And I think we need to really look at the most effective ways to raise revenue on earned as well as unearned income. And surtaxes, unfortunately, are all exclusively on earned income, not unearned. And I think that that's going to leave us far short of our goals. So that would be my answer. I think that we can definitely, we have to have a discussion, and I think the Senate Finance Committee is having it today, about how do we best and most effectively finance health reform. And I think that there are a number of proposals that need to be on the table and seriously considered.
Hi, Anna Summers with the Hilltop Institute at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I'm hoping you all can talk me down, if you will. This discussion around the increased or adjusted federal matching rate seems to be centering along this higher income bracket where there's a lot of variability across states. You've already pointed out a lot of the problems and inequities associated with that, given the differences in baseline commitments across states. I haven't heard this idea floated, and I'm wondering if you can talk about maybe the significant disadvantages of this is to reverse that allocation and look at an adjustment to the lowest income brackets. So, for instance, covering providing 100% federal subsidy for that income level under 30% of poverty, let's say. That's a group that every state covers. It's a group that has higher participation levels across states compared to other income brackets, and therefore there's more sort of embedded equity across states. And when I think about it, and I haven't thought about it a lot, but when I think about it, the factors that would determine variation in states are these are factors that are outside of states' control. You know, their percentage of chronically unemployed, their percentage of disabled, for instance. And then there seem to be some advantages to looking at it this way because there's probably also a lot of overlap with the dual population, the elderly, and other groups where there is some interest in shifting costs to the feds. So can you think of some perhaps significant disadvantages of taking this approach?
I mean, this is a fairly straightforward average cost versus marginal cost problem. Mm-hmm. So the state's total outlays are based on the total amount of expenditures minus whatever they get back from the federal government. When we're trying to motivate states to change their behavior, you want to lower the marginal cost of that change. So in SCHIP, mm-hmm. even though it's a higher income population, we gave a higher match rate to give states a stronger incentive to take the next step. So the question, I think, appropriately posed is do you need the marginal cost incentive anymore in a universal system? If we really get the whole way there, then the marginal decisions of states at the higher income levels probably aren't as important because there's a federal safety net or a federal program. And so all that matters is the table at the end of the day that Sheila referred to, which looks at, you know, states winning and losing. And if you shift where you're getting your match from and what population that's associated with, but in the end, it's the right amount of money, then states sign on the bottom line, and if it isn't, they walk away. So I think the real, to me, that's really the question is, if we're moving into a system that's sufficiently coherent and complete that we're not worried about trying to keep the marginal incentives at the edge for state behavior, then I think flipping it makes perfect sense. It sends the right message about the value of the population. It probably, as you say, automatically responds to some of the problems we have in the current system, but it then reduces the incentive for the marginal shift at the upper edge, and that's something I think we'd worry about giving up unless we knew that there were protections at that level.
Okay, next question.
Hi, I'm Joan Alker with the Georgetown Center for Children and Families, and I wanted to pick up on the comments you made, Alan, which I thought were excellent about some of the challenges in integrating public and private coverage as we move to some kind of expansion use of Medicaid as a base. And also, Sheila, I thought you made some excellent points about some of the politics around those issues. And for the population, I think you see some discussion in the Finance Committee options of using, for example, premium assistance, which I think, Alan, you outlined some of the operational challenges. But I wanted to also stress, I think, the point you made, Sheila, about the cost comparison, because, you know, states have been trying to do this, and I think particularly for the expansion population, we're talking about the very lowest income adults, there's not a lot of there. So it would be unfortunate to end up with a situation where states had to go down a path that wasn't very productive. And so I think it's just going to be important to keep in mind what we know, that there hasn't been a lot of cost savings there. It's been pretty complicated as we move forward. And then I had a question for John. I haven't heard any discussion of this, and I don't know if you were able to look at this in your model, but I think it's accurate to say that a lot of low-income adults, the very lowest income adults, are actually veterans. And I don't know if there's been any estimates of cost savings to the VA to the extent that they're getting some health care. They're getting it through the VA in some cases. I don't know if anybody's looked at that issue.
We didn't, and it's an interesting point. I mean, and maybe it's something that we should try to see if there's a way to take a look at it. It's a really interesting idea.
Other question? We have one in the back.
Hi, Stacey Sanders from Wider Opportunities for Women. I'm curious about long-term care because so much of Medicaid costs to the states are in the long-term care programs. Is there a role for long-term care reform, either through rebalancing to home care alternatives or other options to create more cost savings in terms of the Medicaid costs?
Thank you for asking that question. I think long-term care is sort of the silent part of this entire discussion, and I think there has been little in the way of attention given to the opportunities and also the challenges that are faced in terms of the state's roles in the financing of long-term care, as well as how long-term care is currently delivered. And so I think the answer is to your question is no. I don't think, at least I'm not aware of, a current discussion about trying to deal with the broader questions of long-term care, changing the nature of the service, the location of the service, the method of financing it, the right balance between public and private sector, since most of the costs are currently borne out of people's pockets, about 50% nationwide. But it is an enormous problem. And one that I worry isn't going to be addressed, and it's certainly one we've successfully avoided for years. But Karen and Alan may know of conversations occurring. I certainly don't.
Karen?
Senator Kennedy, through the HELP Committee, has put together two groups of workhorses, and one deals with long-term care. And it has virtually every, on the long-term care side, virtually every group representing the disabled population, seniors, advocates, health plans, just a range of different folks trying to work through this policy question that you posed, which is how do we integrate efforts, and to the extent we're moving in down one path in healthcare reform, how can we think about synergistically lining up what's done in long-term care? So there's a proposal that Senator Kennedy has. There is a great deal of discussion going on about how best to do this, as Sheila indicated. And one of the things that I think is emerging from that that I'm very very encouraged about, and I was going to use the word excited, and really that's a better word, excited about, is I think in healthcare reform, at a minimum, what we're going to end up with is a real focus on the duals. What do we do with the duals? How do we improve their care? How do we better coordinate? What are the barriers to doing that? And then the point you raised about should we continue to treat long-term care in a demonstration-like manner. That makes no, on the community care side, that makes no sense in today's delivery system. That's a decision that reflected the predominant way of delivering long-term care when Medicaid was passed was, of course, through nursing homes, and now it's home and community-based care. That's what advocates want. That's what the population wants. At the same time, we need, obviously, nursing home care to be integrated with that. So getting this right is very, very important, not only from the perspective of providing the highest quality of care, but embedded in John's numbers is some assumptions about how do we improve value, how do we get the biggest bang for the investment. And I think that this is a very important conversation. So I'm glad you raised it as well, and I'm very excited about the conversations that are going on. And I do think at a minimum there will be certain things done. And even there are a number of individuals who have strong commitment to doing even more, and I think that's a very productive dialogue at present. Then the question is, how do you pay for it all? How do you line it all up? And those, of course, are going to be issues that the Finance Committee is focusing on today. But a great deal of the debate will turn on those questions and how we answer them.
Ella.
Let me just quickly add that I think we need to be thoughtful about the language on this issue, because long-term care is a service. And when we say we should do something about long-term care, we're saying there's a lot of unmet need, and the first question is how are we going to pay for it? But the people who need long-term care services are people who also generally need acute care services. And when we start talking, although the duals, you know, it's an awkward term, at least we're now talking about a category of people. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about improving the efficiency of service delivery for people who have acute and chronic needs and chronic and long-term needs, and a continuum of services that are not well met by the current financing and delivery system, we have an opportunity, I think, to discuss this issue in a way that is not just about, oh, who's going to, you know, we're already taking on $1 trillion. How can we possibly pay for more services? So, Karen, I hope you're right that this really is an opportunity. I think it's the tendency has been we're already taking on so much we can't possibly do this. But if we can focus on maybe not all of the populations that require long-term care services, but some of them, and particularly the ones paid for by public programs, and think about how do we improve services, I think that really is an opportunity we have now that's unique.
Well, I clearly think today we've managed to go through all the responsibilities that Medicaid now picks up for the low-income population and come full circle to really talk about the complex population it serves with acute and long-term care needs at the end, which I think is why, as we move forward in healthcare reform, clearly stabilizing the base of the Medicaid program for the populations it now serves, thinking about how to build on that in the most effective way to cover some of the additional populations that are low income and many with special health needs as well, is the question of the day. And I hope that the Finance Committee is moving forward to figure out how to pay for all of this, because I think it is a critical need. And we have to also think about how these things get phased in, and the transition issues that were raised here today are that maybe we start at one place and we move toward another as we get experience and as we understand the implications. Because at the end of the day, I think what we all have to remember is when we're talking about the lowest income population, we're talking about a population with a substantial share of individuals with really significant and complex health needs who are very fragile, and we need to try and assure that in moving forward, we do no harm as well as provide coverage for the American population. So I thank you all for coming today. We'll continue to try and answer questions like Vicki's of what are the implications of some of the options being put on the table. But at least today, I think we started a discussion about Medicaid and its role and the possible framework it can provide for health care reform in the future. So thank you all, and thank you to all of the panelists and to John and his team at Urban for the great work that we started the discussion with. Thank you.